The stage is dark except for a line of pale bulbs along the pit rail, like a runway at night. Players settle, pages rustle. A pair of horns trade quiet arpeggios as if clearing their throats. You can feel a giant machine poised to breathe. The conductor raises his hand, and at first there is almost nothing, only the deepest octave, a subterranean growl you don't so much hear as inhabit. Then a single tone starts to bloom, and another, and then trumpets step forward with a phrase that seems as old as sunrise and as new as electricity. It is not a melody so much as a declaration. The world is about to reveal itself again. Somewhere a listener thinks, I know this, space movies, an opening shot of the sun lifting over the edge of a planet. And yet this is 1896, long before film learned to speak. The piece is called Also Sprach Zarathustra. And the man who wrote it learned to bend an orchestra the way an engineer bends steel. Richard Strauss was born in 1864 in Munich, a city whose opera house was both a workplace and a pulpit for his father, Franz, principal horn and uncompromising guardian of classical virtues. Franz Strauss distrusted Wagner the way a lighthouse distrusts fog, not out of spite, but out of a conviction that safety depends on clarity. He taught the boy that Mozart was grammar, and Beethoven was courage, and that elegance was a moral duty. The child listened, wrote tidy keyboard pieces and chamber music, and grew up fluent in restraint. Then an older musician, Alexander Ritter, a violinist devoted to Liszt and to Wagner's long, glowing sentences, put new books and new sounds in the young man's hands. Suddenly the tiny rooms had doors in their walls. Strauss did not become a Wagnerian so much as a practical modern, willing to borrow power wherever he found it, unwilling to surrender balance or wit in the bargain. The path opened quickly. In his early 20s, Strauss took a job with the Meiningen Orchestra, one of those disciplined German ensembles that functioned like laboratories for the future. He learned to rehearse, to listen to sections as if they were actors with distinct temperaments, to fix problems by moving a single clarinet line a single step. He learned how to ask for impossible things and then make them seem natural. The first tone poem that fully announced him, Don Juan, in 1888, arrived like a young man kicking the door of a salon. The strings leapt in acrobatic confidence, the winds flirted and mocked, the brass spoke in sentences that did not apologize for their size. You could hear in it a personality impatient with piety and intoxicated by the idea that music could be a narrative with nerves and blood. Strauss did not invent the tone poem. Liszt had already smelted literature into symphonic metal, but Strauss enlarged the foundry. He sharpened the storytelling until motives behaved like characters, harmony like plot twists, orchestration like light. Ton und Verklärung, death and transfiguration, pushed the metaphysical register. A life's fragments returning at the edge of breath, an arrival in blazing C major that is both triumph and mercy. Till Eulenspiegel's lustige strikey, till Eulenspiegel's merry pranks, made mischief a principle, a rogue's laughter captured in a French horn theme that can turn sly in an instant and then vault into the rafters. Don Quixote transformed the orchestra into a stage where a solo cello becomes a noble delusion and a solo viola becomes common sense, and where windmills truly do swing like giants if the right tremolo shivers beneath them. Ein Heldenleben, A Hero's Life, dared autobiography without shame, painting a hero whose foes are woodwind chatterers and whose love is a solo violin so lavish and demanding that real relationships blush in recognition. By the time he reached Also Sprach Zarathustra, Strauss had mastered a technique that sounds obvious until you try it. Treat the orchestra not as a choir of blended color, but as a city of speakers, some eloquent, some blunt, some comic, some ceremonial, and stage conversations among them. The famous opening is Only the Flag. The piece that follows murmurs and argues, prays and parades. It was never meant to be a philosophy lecture. It was an encounter with grandeur, with the stubborn human wish to stand at dawn and feel that the world still faces forward. Then came the theater, and Strauss discovered that his orchestra, so good at speech, could turn dangerous when speech sharpened into drama. He had conducted opera for years. He had learned the psychology of singers and the geometry of pits. He had watched audiences lean forward and pull back like a tide governed by moons of scandal and delight. In 1905, he unveiled Salome, a one-act explosion welded from Oscar Wilde's play, and Europe divided into camps. Some walked out, some fainted, some cheered, some counted the bars and wondered who would be brave enough to program it again. The piece is not merely about a dance and a kiss and a head. It is about desire that refuses to pretend it is anything else. The harmonies push past politeness until they reach truth. The orchestration glitters like cut glass. The final scene hangs on a line, "Ich habe deinen Mund beküsst, Johannon," that a singer must carry like a weapon and a wound. Strauss's gift was not shock, it was accuracy. He wrote the music that the scene required, even if it scorched the wallpaper. 4 years later, Elektra took that accuracy and fed it iron. With Hugo von Hofmannsthal as librettist, a collaborator whose intelligence would become a second voice in Strauss's head, he drove the orchestra into regions that felt less like harmony and more like geology. Plates grinding, fault lines opening, the human voice pressing its way through strata of sound. The plot is ancient, but the experience is modern. Trauma speaking in rhythms that do not close, obsession drawing circles that never quite return to the starting point. Recognition arriving not as sentiment, but as shock. For some listeners, Elektra is the most radical thing Strauss ever did, a commitment to dissonance not as effect, but as the right angle for a particular light. And then, with equal conviction, he turned and wrote Der Rosenkavalier. How do you set that pivot on a calendar? 1911. Between one decade and another, a composer who had walked to the edge of the cliff came back to the city and threw a ball. Waltzes everywhere, scandalously delicious, melting into one another like pastries in a dream. A story set in an 18th century Vienna that never quite existed, where an older woman, wise, funny, wounded, releases the young man she loves with a grace that still catches in the throat. People called it a retreat, a concession to popularity, a betrayal of whatever modern meant that week. But listen without the polemics. The orchestration is as cunning as ever. The harmonies slip like letters passed under doors, and the human truth is not lighter simply because the surfaces gleam. The presentation of the rose suspends time so gently, you may not notice that time has been suspended. And the final trio builds a ladder out of breath itself. Strauss was not retreating. He was proving that irony and tenderness can share a room. Between those poles, he and Hofmannsthal built a gallery of forms. Ariadne auf Naxos, first as an afterpiece to a play, and then, in 1916, remade into a compact jewel where high comedy and myth meet in the same courtyard. Die Frau ohne Schatten, an allegory writ in blazing orchestral color about fertility and identity and the shadows cast by choice. Arabella, their last completed collaboration, where charm and class and money and desire dance polite figures while the orchestra whispers what politeness dares not say. When Hofmannsthal died in 1929, Strauss wrote to a friend as if a part of his own ear had gone silent. The next librettist, Stefan Zweig, Jewish, cosmopolitan, humane, helped in fashion Die Schweigsame Frau, a comedy of language so affectionate that the censors who later suppressed it felt, in suppressing it, that they had achieved a moral victory. History keeps its receipts. We can read them now and blush for them. The 1930s are the part of Strauss's story where music has to share the page with weather. He became, briefly, the president of a new Reich music chamber, a committee post under a regime that meant to reorganize everything, including conscience. He took the job, kept writing, tried to protect his Jewish daughter-in-law and grandchildren, and collaborated by correspondence with Zweig until a letter, impatient with politics, proud of art, and tender toward his friend, was intercepted. He was dismissed. The piece they made together was banned. Later, he wrote Friedenstag, which looks like an offering to the times and also like a wish. He wrote Daphne, a pastoral that pretends to be only a pastoral and is more. He wrote Capriccio, a conversation piece that turns the old argument, what comes first, the words or the music, into an evening of civilized longing. None of this excuses. None of it is simple. But even here, you can hear the through line, a belief that music is a place where thought can act. After the war, he faced denazification, relocations, the shame of ruined buildings, opera houses in ashes like broken instruments in an empty case. In that ruin, he wrote a lament, Metamorphosen, for 23 solo strings. It sounds like marble weeping. What does Strauss sound like when he is not in public? Start with the leader, the songs. Early and late, he remembered the voice as the first instrument that ever mattered to him. Zueignung strides forward like a declaration of love, stamped with a ring. Morgan seems to hold its own breath until the violin line arrives like a lift of air. Sakilia knows exactly how hearts race. Befreit understands how gratitude can bruise. And then, at the end, Vier letzte Lieder, the four last songs, set to poems by Hesse and Eichendorff, written in the late 1940s by a man who had seen two world wars and more funerals than anyone should count. Frühling opens the window and lets spring in like a guest. September tastes the air and hears the garden closing. Beim Schlafen gehen rests the violin on the singer's shoulder the way a tired friend rests a head. Im Abendrot stands at evening with a partner and asks at last, Ist dies etwa der Tod? Is this perhaps death? The orchestra answers not with certainty, but with a transfigured memory. A phrase from Death and Transfiguration returns, not as a quotation for clever listeners, but as a memory the composer's own body would have known. A life circle closes without pomp. Between the salons and the stations of history, there is a craftsman as exacting as any watchmaker. Strauss knew the physics of halls. He knew how a horn call leaves a hand and arcs into air, how a triangle can write a glint on the wall, how a tam-tam can make a door open in a listener's body. He asked for off-stage bands not because it was a trick, but because distance has meaning. He asked for organ not because it is loud, but because it is weight. He used harps like eyelashes and tubas like stone. He wrote parts that terrify orchestras and then make them proud of themselves. He could turn three clarinets into gossip and three trombones into government. He wrote two horn concertos as love letters to the instrument that lived in his childhood kitchen. Late in life, he wrote an oboe concerto so poised, so grateful for breath, that it sounds like a man who has decided that grace is the most rebellious mood left. If you want to understand how cunning he is, listen to how he paces revelation. In Till Eulenspiegel, the prankster's theme is always a half second early or late, arriving at the precise wrong time as if, like a good thief, it knew where the locks were. In Ein Heldenleben, when the hero returns to love, the harmony does not simply relax, it negotiates with the day's injuries, and when the solo violin climbs, it is not an athlete vaulting, but a person reaching for a hand already offered. In Der Rosenkavalier, when the Marschallin speaks about time, the orchestra finds a way to count without counting. In Salome, at the very end, the brass do not gloat. They clarify the air so that the shock lands in silence. He believed in rehearsal because he believed in visibility. There is nothing in his scores that a listener must understand with a textbook. Everything is legible at the speed of life if the playing is honest. That was his standard as a conductor too. He did not want sermons about interpretation. He wanted clean articulation, rhythms that don't sag, a string sheen that is not a sneer. Rehearsal reports from his tours read like field notes from a botanist, tiny corrections producing large blooms. He made early recordings that surprise modern ears by their directness, tempi a shade faster than fashion, dynamics that don't wallow, a refusal to sentimentalize even when sentiment is the subject. He trusted that the music would make its own case if nobody tried to improve it. Strauss's reputation goes in cycles because he sits in a crossroads that makes some listeners choose teams. To one camp, he is the last romantic, polishing waltzes and sunsets while the century burns. To another, he is the first modern film composer, the man who taught sound how to stand behind pictures. To another, he is a conservative chameleon who flirted with the edge and then backed away toward plush chairs. To another, he is a cynic who laughed at heroism, even while staging it. But the records of his labor point to something plainer. A citizen of the theater with an engineer's pride and an artist's conscience. He would use any language necessary to make his scene true. If the scene required a howl, he brought the brass. If it required a whisper, he cut the orchestra down to a breath and a violin line that shakes exactly once. Consider Eine Alpensymphonie, a piece sometimes mocked for its travel brochure titles: Night, Sunrise, The Ascent, On the Glacier, Near the Waterfall, Thunder and Storm. What saves it from kitsch is not just the orchestration, though the wind machine, the thunder sheet, the organ, and the herds of brass certainly strut, but the way the whole day is paced like a confession. The Ascent is not an excuse for heroics. It is an inventory of effort. The Storm is not a trick. It is a report. And when night falls again, you feel not exhausted by an entertainment, but educated by a landscape. Or take Capriccio, the last opera he completed. Begun in 1940 and premiered in 1942, while Europe was in flames. In a drawing room outside Paris, artists argue gently, fiercely, endlessly, about whether music or words are the soul of opera. The Countess at the center listens, flirts, refuses to choose, then walks into a long private monologue that sounds like a person arranging furniture in a room that is about to be requisitioned by history. It is an opera and about the habit of civilization, the stubborn wish to keep talking beautifully while the world outside turns feral. You can hear in it neither denial nor protest, but a kind of secular prayer that talking beautifully might be, in itself, a protest. The moral accounting remains. What should an artist have done in a time like his? What did he do? The biographical answers are mixed, and the judgments will never settle into unanimity. What we can say for the purposes of music is that he did not stop trying to make accurate signals in air. Even in compromise, he wrote with the precision of a surgeon and the appetite of a cook. Even in luxury, he slipped knives into the upholstery. Even in lightness, he let gravity show through. The work does not blanch or plead. It remains stubbornly itself, inviting us to argue with it in good faith. If you're new to Strauss, you could tiptoe in or leap. Tiptoeing might be Morgan, a song whose last page, with a violin climbing over the voice and a sustained note that tastes like resilience, can make a room hold still. Leaping might be Salome whole, if your nerves like electricity. Or Der Rosenkavalier, for the way laughter carries grief like a second melody. Or the first 2 minutes of Zarathustra. Because sometimes you just need to feel the floor shake and remember that human beings learned how to build a sunrise out of brass and organ. If you already know him, listen again with a question. Where in this vast apparatus is the simplest human truth hiding? In Electra, it might be a single oboe phrase that looks like a hand on a shoulder. In Arabella, it might be a hotel corridor harmony that admits how much of love is logistics. In Don Quixote, it might be the moment when the cello's grandeur breaks into humility and the viola catches it as if preventing a fall. In the four last songs, it is the air itself, the sense that the voice is being carried rather than carrying. Strauss died in 1949 in Garmisch. With mountain air that had seen him young and clever, then famous and embattled, then old and still writing. A priest would call that a life. An archivist would call it a collection. A musician might call it a repertoire. We can call it a proof that the orchestra remains a place where human complexity can be measured and made audible. That opera remains a theater where the truth can sing, even when nobody can bear to say it. That a single horn call can remind a person that courage has a sound. Some composers feel like ideals. Others feel like acquaintances. Strauss feels like a city you can live in. There are neighborhoods for every mood. A plaza for parades, back streets for jokes, industrial zones where the heat distorts the air, gardens where the shade is designed, boulevards where history rides open carriages and nods irresistibly to Walt's time. It is possible to get lost there. It is also possible to find yourself walking without a map and realize, to your surprise, that you know exactly where you are going because the street you are on is named after a feeling and you have felt it before. He did not ask us to worship him. He asked us to listen for the accuracy with which a moment can be drawn. He showed how orchestration is not paint, but physics. He argued in scores, not essays, that complexity is not a vice when it attends to truth, and that simplicity is not a virtue when it lies. He left tools behind, a way to pace a scene, a way to release tension without wasting it, a way to write for voices that gives them their dignity and their danger. and he left some of the most unembarrassedly beautiful pages ever put in front of a singer, which is not nothing. So we return to the pit. The lights are still a string of dim stars. The audience breathes in the plural. The conductor's hand rises again. The bass speaks first, the trumpets answer, and morning is rebuilt out of pressure and brass. It never gets old because it never was about novelty. It was always about recognition. The sun rises, and a person recognizes the world. That recognition is what Strauss orchestrated better than anyone. Thank you for listening to this episode of Classical Music Giants. In our next stage, we walk into the northern clarity and granite patience of Jean Sibelius, where silence has structure and symphonies grow like pines in winter light. Produced by Selenius Media and the Artificial Laboratory.